Following the opening title card reading, "Look at Life," Lucas made his intentions immediately clear with his first on-screen credit. This was no student assignment. It was a short film by George Lucas. Furthermore, Lucas had chosen to set his film to music, in open defiance of Kosor's instructions. Selecting Antonio Carlos Jobim's furious percussion piece, A Felicidad Batucada, from the soundtrack of the 1959 film Black Orpheus. Over the next 55 seconds, in perfect sync with an explosion of drums and other percussion instruments, Lucas barraged viewers with a machine gun fire of images hurtling across the screen one after another. The images are mostly of unrest and disorder, race riots, police dogs attacking protesters, gesturing politicians, dead bodies. For a moment, the whoosh of images of protesters and riots gives way to the word love, followed by couples kissing and young women dancing. Images seem to throb and pulse with the rhythm of the drums, a page right out of Vorkapich's book, until Lucas finally pulls slowly back from a photo of a young man with his hands up, blood streaming from his nose, as a preacher loudly quotes from Proverbs, "Hate stirreth up strife, while love covereth all sins." Lucas ends on an equivocal downbeat, with a clipping reading, "Anyone for survival," which fades first into "end," and then trails off into a lone question mark, which slowly recedes into a blur. Fini. Even 50 years later, Look at Life is an impressive debut, aggressive, political, and utterly confident. As soon as I made my first film, I thought, hey, I'm good at this, I know how to do this, said Lucas. From then on, I've never questioned it. Even in his first 60 seconds of film, Lucas's talent for astute and clever editing is on full display. Lucas cuts from one figure's upward-pointing finger immediately to another's waving hand. Moments later, he follows a photo of a kissing couple with a still of Dracula sinking his teeth into a woman's neck. At other times, Lucas gives the illusion of movement by panning his camera quickly across a photo of fleeing protesters or of a young woman dancing. With this film, I was introduced to film editing, the whole concept of editing, said Lucas, and I think ultimately that film editing was where my real talent was. His animation class was stunned. It completely energized the class just looking at this thing, said Murch. Nobody expected anything like this. Everyone turned around and said, who did that? And it was George. Lucas was suddenly the boy wonder. Nobody there, including all the teachers, had ever seen anything like it, he recalled. It made my mark in the department. That was when I suddenly developed a lot more friendships, and the instructor said, oh, we've got a live one here. It was the first time, too, said Murch, when we saw that spark that George had that nobody else had in quite the same way. Lucas finished his first year at USC in triumph, but the work had taken a toll on his health. He came down with mononucleosis. It probably hadn't helped that most of his meals still came from the DKA vending machines and snack bar, but it's unlikely he had contracted mono in the usual way college students do. George was chasing girls, said Milius cheekily. He didn't catch them, but he was chasing them. While the USC Mafia may have tittered over Lucas's coming down with the so-called kissing disease, they all knew it was stress, and not smooching, that had worn their young friend out. With his first year behind him, Lucas could finally abandon dorm life, and he literally headed for the hills, renting a three-story, two-bedroom wood frame house at 9803 Portola Drive in the hills of Benedict Canyon, about a half-hour drive from USC. The place was low rent in every sense of the word, perched at the top of a steep set of concrete steps poured into the hillside with cramped bedrooms, closet-sized bathrooms, and a top-floor bedroom accessible only by an outside ladder. Lucas's father grudgingly agreed to pay the $80 monthly rent, and Lucas, feeling slightly guilty, eventually decided to bring in Randall Kleiser as his roommate, thereby splitting the costs and reducing his father's out-of-pocket expenses. Kleiser was a good influence on Lucas, clean-cut, self-effacing, outgoing, and inclined to bring Lucas into social situations, whether Lucas liked it or not. Kleiser, in fact, made Lucas a founding member of what he dubbed the Clean Cut Cinema Club, also bringing in Don Glut, former Lucas roommate Randy Epstein, and a young man named Chris Lewis, the son of Oscar and Emmy-winning actress Loretta Young, as the club's first members. While it was set up mostly as a support group for talking about and working on one another's film projects, George's relationship with his friends was more about making films, Lucas's first wife would later remark. It was still the most outgoing Lucas had been, well, pretty much ever. Still, Kleiser wasn't going to be able to change Lucas too much. Despite his best efforts, Kleiser found that Lucas preferred shutting himself in his top-floor bedroom, sitting at the drawing board, planning his films, and sketching out ideas. "I would always try to go out to parties and to clubs and stuff," said Kleiser, "and George would usually stay upstairs in his room, drawing these little star troopers. But for Lucas, that was even better than partying. I'd be working all day, all night, living on chocolate bars and coffee," said Lucas. "It was a great life." Even as drugs were becoming more prevalent on college campuses, chocolate bars and coffee, as well as chocolate chip cookies and Coca-Cola, would be the worst junk Lucas put into his body. "I had all that young enthusiasm, and I was too busy to get into drugs," he said. "After a while, I could see it was a bad idea anyway." For Lucas, movies, not marijuana, were his addiction, and if he had a moment to spare, he, and most of his film school friends actually, thought the films of Akira Kurosawa and George Cukor provided the best kind of high. "We were passionate about movies. It was like an addiction," he said. "We were always scrambling to get our next fix, to get a little film in the camera and shoot something." Lucas was even working on projects that went beyond those assigned in class. During his senior year, he, Kleiser, and Lewis would form their own production company, Sunrise Productions, with offices on Sunset Boulevard, Kleiser stressed. And in the spirit of the cineasts they imagined themselves to be, Kleiser made up snappier stage names for himself and Lucas. "I was Randall John," said Kleiser, "and he was Lucas Beaumont." Sunrise Productions would produce exactly one short film. 5-4-3 was the title of a self-aware nod to the countdown scene at the front end of a film, a mockumentary on the making of a satirical teen beach movie called Orgy Beach Party. Lucas shot in a documentary style, following Kleiser around as he rescued his bikini-clad girlfriend from Don Glut's monster. While on the soundtrack, studio executives hooted at the film. It was self-referential and self-deprecating, and never completed. Lucas began his senior year in the autumn of 1965. With most of the preliminary requirements out of the way, he could at last immerse himself entirely in film-related classes. Finally, he could enroll in Cinema 310, a film production class with the arty name The Language of Film, where he would be able to make real films using real film equipment rather than hijacking an animation camera as he had with Look at Life. Students were permitted to assemble small teams to serve as their film crews, and Lucas, already determined to do as much of the work himself as he could, looked no further than the Clean Cut Cinema Club, tapping Kleiser and Lewis to perform mostly as actors and equipment managers. Lucas's Cinema 310 film was a 3-minute Cold War thriller come political statement called Freiheit, the German word for freedom. Filmed entirely in Malibu Canyon, Freiheit starred Kleiser, in shirt sleeves and loafers, necktie askew, glasses slightly crooked, as a terrified young man being chased by unseen pursuers as he makes his way toward the line of fence separating communist East Germany from democratic West Germany. With the border and freedom in sight, Kleiser's student sprints across an open space, only to be cut down agonizingly by machine gun fire within feet of his destination. As a voiceover oozes platitudes, "Freedom's a thing you have to deserve," says one voice. You have to work for it. Kleiser makes one last lunge for the fence before being brought down by another hail of bullets. As the credits roll, Chris Lewis, decked out like a Soviet soldier, stands over the fallen Kleiser, weapon in hand. Of course, freedom's worth dying for, intones an off-screen voice. Because without freedom, we're dead. I went to marches in the 60s, said Lucas, but I wasn't an instigator of anything. And yet, with Freiheit, Lucas is clearly and aggressively making a statement. It's very much a film by a young man who wants to be taken seriously as an artist and insurgent. And to his credit, it sort of works. He was able to do something that was artistic but also commercial, noted Kleiser. It had a lot of slick style to it. In Freiheit, Lucas is working in a more straight-ahead narrative style than in Look at Life, using a blue-tinted monochrome to give the film an otherworldly, slightly sinister look. And once again, it's Lucas's feel for editing that makes the film pop. As Kleiser waits in the brush for his chance to run for the fence, Lucas holds on the panting Kleiser for almost too long, which makes his failed break for freedom even more excruciating. And as Kleiser sprints, Lucas briefly cuts in a joggling shot from Kleiser's perspective, making the viewer, for one brief moment, the runner and victim. As a political piece, it's a young Lucas being intentionally provocative, if heavy-handed, from the slow-motion shots of the anguished Kleiser running for the fence, all the way down to a title sequence that solemnly identifies Freiheit as a film by Lucas. In the 50s, I was not very aware of the events that were going on around me, said Lucas. It wasn't until Kennedy was killed that I became involved in a lot of things that I hadn't paid much attention to before. Kleiser recalled Lucas being annoyed by students who romanticized dying in Vietnam in the name of freedom. George wanted to make a statement about how easy it is to say that, but how in reality, people were getting killed. Ultimately, Freiheit's underlying question, what price freedom, was one Lucas would explore and struggle with in the decades to follow, both as an artist and as a businessman. Inside and outside the classroom, Lucas continued to immerse himself in films by a wide variety of filmmakers. Film school was a perfect place for me to be exposed to a lot of different kinds of films, said Lucas. In the days before DVDs or streaming video, a small art film or foreign film had to come to some art house. Otherwise, you had to see it at 2 o'clock in the morning on television, or you could see it in film school. When it came to American directors, Lucas was particularly interested in the films of John Ford and William Wyler, the latter an influential director and cinematographer remembered not only for winning 3 Academy Awards, but also for his inability to relate to actors, a criticism that would later be leveled at Lucas. Godard and Fellini remained Lucas's foreign gods. He was a particularly big fan of Godard's latest, the sci-fi film noir dystopian thriller, Alphaville, in which the director used modern-day Paris as a stand-in for the futuristic title city. But lately, he'd discovered a new idol, Japanese director Akira Kurosawa. At the encouragement of John Milius, Lucas went to see several Kurosawa films at the La Brea Cinema in Los Angeles and remembered being really blown away by the director's 1954 film, The Seven Samurai. It really had a huge influence on my life in terms of seeing something that brilliant and something that emotional, and at the same time, so exotic, said Lucas. He loved Kurosawa's style. So strong and unique, with the horizontal wipes to transition between scenes, the rat-a-tat editing, and the dusty, slightly worn look of his sets and costumes. Everything in a Kurosawa movie looked as if it had been used, repaired, then used again, a design aesthetic that Lucas would bring to Star Wars. Lucas also liked that Kurosawa was confident enough in his storytelling to plunk audiences down in the middle of medieval or 19th century Japan without the benefit of backstory. Give audiences a bit of time with the mythology, thought Kurosawa, and the foreign would feel familiar. Another conceit Lucas would bring to Star Wars. And yet, Even with his filmic vocabulary expanding, Lucas would return to the more familiar language of Vorkopich for his third film, Herbie, completed for his Cinema 405 class. This time, instructor Sherwood Omens paired the senior Lucas with junior Paul Golding. Lucas likely grumbled. He was becoming increasingly cranky about the idea of working with others and preferred doing everything himself. He could be easily irritated if he was saddled with crew members who couldn't keep up with him. I was really incensed at the democratic process of filmmaking, where we helped the student who couldn't quite make it, Lucas said later. I was into making it a competition, who could get it done first and best. If they couldn't cut the mustard, they shouldn't have been there. Golding, however, would pass the Lucas litmus test. He was an enthusiastic collaborator who also happened to bring to the table the keys to the film school stockroom, thereby ensuring that only he and Lucas had access to the highly coveted Arriflex camera. That was the sort of go-getting defiance Lucas could rally behind, and he and Golding, who also prided himself on his editing abilities, would collaborate on several more films at USC. After the politics of both Look at Life and Freiheit, Herbie is positively mellow. Gorgeous black and white shots of nighttime lights reflected in the curves of cars. Finally, Lucas could feature a car. As the smooth jazz of the Miles Davis Quintet playing Basin Street Blues fills the soundtrack. The name Herbie, in fact, comes from pianist Herbie Hancock, who Lucas and Golding mistakenly thought was playing piano on the piece. It was actually Hancock's predecessor in the quintet, Victor Feldman. Like Vorkopich's pictorial fantasies, Herbie injams unrelated images and music to create an entirely new yet somehow cohesive piece. It's film jazz in every sense, and as the final note of music fades, the lone on-screen credit quietly states that these moments of reflection have been brought to you by Paul Golding and George Lucas. After his first three films, it was becoming impossible for Lucas to keep a low profile, despite his best efforts. George was always quiet, said Walter Murch. He wasn't one of the people who would always be speaking out in class. He tended to keep his own counsel and to express himself through his films. But now, after his first short productions, he was recognized as being the star. As Matthew Robbins remembered, Lucas was highly regarded by all the students, and a source of puzzlement to much of the faculty. Regardless of what the faculty may have thought of the tight-lipped young man, his films got their attention, and it was clear he was also becoming one of USC's most dexterous editors. While other students griped and complained about bad acting, absent crew members, unreliable equipment, or lack of adequate time to get the shots they wanted, Lucas worked quickly and without complaint. He'd cover up any defects, shortages, or missing shots in the editing room. It's little wonder that Lucas would be at home in both the editing room and on editing equipment. The USC editing room looked like an auto shop class, with high ceilings, buzzing overhead lights, graffiti-covered walls, and equipment taking up most of the floor space. And the Moviola editing machines were Lucas's kind of contraption, as comfortable for him as sliding behind the wheel of a car, with foot pedals to control the speed of the film, a handbrake, a variable motor switch, and a viewing screen the size of a rearview mirror. Small motors whirred as students spooled film back and forth. Discarded snippets of film were simply dropped to the floor to be swept up later. It became as familiar as working on his own car at the Foreign Auto Service. Plus, knowing his way around engines as he did, Lucas didn't need long to figure out how to fix the notoriously unreliable Moviolas, which broke down with frustrating regularity. Some envious members of the DKA fraternity regarded Lucas as little more than a showboat and a dilettante, but DKA President Howard Kazanjian stuck by Lucas and even threatened to resign if Lucas wasn't voted in. It was an act of friendship and loyalty that Lucas would reward years later, when Kazanjian became a vice president of Lucas's own company, as well as his go-to producer for films like Raiders of the Lost Ark and Return of the Jedi. Despite his official status with DKA, though, Lucas's only real involvement with the fraternity was using it as a source of fuel for his marathon work sessions, as he continued to ransack the vending machines and snack bar for cookies and cokes. Lucas reached the Cinema 480 class in the final semester of his senior year. Here, instructor Douglas Cox would break the class into small crews to complete a 10-minute film with three-track synchronized sound in a period of 10 weeks. The problem with working in an assigned crew meant, as classmate Don Glut noted testily, not all of us were granted the esteemed privilege of actually directing a project. Lucas, however, would both write and direct his senior project, heading up a crew that would eventually swell to 14, some of whom would receive on-screen credit, some of whom wouldn't. They'd all be working together closely, sure, but ultimately, they'd be doing it Lucas's way. Cox also imposed some terms and conditions on the project, most of which Lucas shrugged off or disregarded entirely. Teams could film in either color or black and white, for instance, but if they chose color, they'd receive only half the amount of film. "They discouraged us from shooting color," said Lucas, "because it takes so long to get it developed." Challenge accepted. Lucas would shoot in color. Cox also required teams to shoot their films close to campus. Lucas would ignore that one altogether and take his team out to a location 80 miles away. The rules were of no concern to him. "I broke them all. All of us did," said Lucas. "Whenever I broke the rules, I made a good film, so there wasn't much the faculty could do about it." The rule-breaking even extended to a bit of pilfering, as well as some breaking and entering. With only a limited amount of time and equipment, competition was fierce for the best cameras and editing machines. Lucas, said Matthew Robbins, was very resourceful. He always would find a way to get what he needed in terms of equipment and bodies to put together a crew. Paul Golding had hoarded the Aeroflex for Lucas to use on Herbie. This time, it was John Milius, always game for a bit of delinquency, who broke into the equipment room and borrowed for Lucas the Eclair NPR camera that Lucas loved. "He really wanted to use that camera," said Milius. "And I stole it and hid it in my car and slept in my car with the camera for a week while we used it. And once it came time to edit, Lucas didn't want to limit his use of the equipment to the building's regular hours either. We'd shimmy up the drain spout, cross over the roof, jump down into the patio, and then break into the editing room so we could work all weekend," said Lucas. For his film, Lucas would combine two of his passions, one old, racing, and one new. "Cinema Verite was just coming in at that point," said Lucas. "We studied that a lot." Cinema Verite, French for truth cinema, was a new kind of documentary filmmaking in which the camera observed real people in uncontrolled situations with no preconceived notions or scripted outcomes. At its purest, it involved little more than using a camera and sound recording equipment to shoot and then present raw, nearly unedited footage. Most of it, however, had a little more flash than that, and Lucas was strongly influenced by the films coming out of the French unit of the National Film Board of Canada, which produced Cinema Verite with verve and attitude. Lucas was particularly fond of director Jean-Claude Lebrecht's 1965 film, 60 Cycles, following bicyclists in the Tour de Saint-Laurent as they wound their way through 1,500 miles of Canadian countryside to the music of Booker T. and the MGs. Lucas flipped out over it, said classmate Charlie Limpincott, who had procured the film from the Canadian consulate. "Part documentary, part slice of life, part experimental film, at 16 minutes, it did all the things that Lucas wanted to do with his 480 film. Long shots, aerial shots, crowds, and, best of all, in the spirit of genuine cinema verite, no actors." Lucas couldn't get enough of it, borrowing it from Lippincott and watching it over and over again, until Lippincott finally had to return it, long overdue, to the impatient Canadians. For his own bit of flashy cinema verite, then, Lucas took his crew to Willow Springs Racetrack in Rosemont to film driver Peter Brock as he put his yellow Lotus 23 through its paces. Lucas captured it all from carefully chosen angles. Sometimes the car seems incidental, glimpsed only as it speeds behind a series of signs in an aerial shot, or seen off in the distance, where the chirp of birds is almost louder than the roar of the engine. Other times, Lucas puts the camera in the car for Brock's perspective from behind the wheel, one eye on the speedometer, or turns the camera on Brock as he works the stick shift, or, in one glorious unscripted moment, grimaces as he cranks the engine after the Lotus spins out and stalls. Finally, Lucas closes in on the face of a stopwatch as a member of the pit crew snaps it to a stop with an audible mechanical click, its hands frozen on Brock's best lap time. 1:42.8 seconds. Lucas would use it as the title of his film. Lucas called 1:42.08 a visual tone poem, reflecting his interest in cars as well as the visual impact of a person going against the clock, a theme he would take up later in THX 1138. At its heart, it's also about a man and technology, another theme Lucas would explore, and our efforts to master technology without letting it master us first, even if we do spin out once or twice. To Lucas's surprise, too, he found he had enjoyed working with a crew and was proud they had brought their project in right on time. "We had only 10 weeks to make the film, from the point that you start the script to the point where you actually have to print," he said. "For students, that's quite an achievement." And that wasn't all that happened out at Willow Springs. While there, Lucas had run into another film crew, an advanced team for the racing film Grand Prix, trailing along after star James Garner as he trained with a stunt driver. With only a minimal amount of sweet-talking, Lucas landed a job as a camera operator on the film's second unit, picking up a few bucks and his first professional Hollywood credits for a few additional days' work at the track. In the end, 1:42.08 might have been a group effort, but Lucas had made his mark by breaking the rules and doing it his way, again. The film didn't wow Lucas's professors quite as much as his previous work, but he was in good shape. Instructor Douglas Cox was a fan of art films. He would clash with Glut over making pulpy monster movies like Wrath of the Sun Demon, and appreciated what Lucas was trying to do. Cinema verite aside, 1:42.08 shows Lucas finding his own style as a director, content to let a well-placed camera almost casually catch the action. And Lucas is almost too creative an editor to ever really do pure cinema verite. He can't resist using a rapid series of flickering cuts to make Brock's Lotus seem to move even faster, or inserting a brief shot of a sign advertising a restaurant named George and Aggie's, a cameo so coy that if you blink, you'll miss it. And in his first true sound film, Lucas already takes great pleasure in seat-rumbling audio as Brock's Lotus screams by again and again, like one of Star Wars' TIE fighters. Lucas graduated from the University of Southern California with a bachelor's degree in cinema on August 6, 1966, and he would always have warm feelings toward USC. "I discovered my talent here," he said during a ceremony at the university in 2006. His future, however, was uncertain. "I assumed I would make the kind of avant-garde films that were being made in San Francisco at that time," he recalled. "You can't make a living making those films, so I figured I'd also work as a documentary cameraman. That's really what I wanted to do anyway. I would be a documentary cameraman for my livelihood and make movies on the side. That was going to be my life." Or so he thought. Like most film school graduates, Lucas found the doors of mainstream movie studios closed to him. "It was impossible to break into the industry in any of the guilds or unions," said Gary Kurtz, who had graduated from USC in 1962, and by 1966 was still working on low-budget films like Beach Ball. A lot of film school graduates just got tired of that process and did other things. They went into educational or documentary films, which weren't so rigidly unionized. The military loomed as well. As an unemployed college graduate, Lucas was eligible for the draft, with a very real possibility of being sent to Vietnam. Lucas considered himself an activist. "I was angry at the time, getting involved in all the causes," he said, "and was opposed to the war. But his friends told him that with his degree and skill set, he could likely be an officer in the Air Force photography unit. Lucas found the idea creatively intriguing. Unlike his classmate John Milius, Lucas saw nothing romantic in the military or war, but he did have to admit that Vietnam had filmic possibilities. If he went to war and survived, the stories of what he saw and did there would make a hell of a film. I was going to spend 2 years somewhere slogging around in the mud, he figured, hoping to get assigned to something reasonable and using the experience to write about in later years. Still, he admitted, I wasn't really that enthusiastic about going in the first place. I was just doing it out of desperation. Enthusiastic or desperate, it never happened. Lucas reported for his induction physical, where, to his utter astonishment, he was rated 4F. He had failed his physical. Doctors had found diabetes, the same disease that had killed his grandfather, Walton. Lucas was put on Oranase and would have to manage his disease with medication for the rest of his life. That also meant no drugs or alcohol, a condition Lucas could easily handle. His clean-cut image would now be true out of necessity. But diabetes also meant giving up the chocolate chip cookies, Hershey bars, and Cokes that Lucas had lived on for pretty much the last 10 years. That would be tougher. With any chance of a military career now off the table, Lucas let his hair grow out, which for him meant it tended to pile up higher on his head rather than trail down his back. He also grew a beard, a dark and neatly trimmed Van Dyke that surrounded his mouth. While he looked more beatnik than hippie, he also looked cool, even with his ears still sticking straight out from his head. Lucas was finding his look. Being rejected for military service also meant that Lucas could return to USC for graduate school, but that too would have to wait. He had missed the chance to enroll for the fall 1966 semester. For a moment, Lucas was aimless, with no job and no real prospects. Finally, he capitalized on one of the only real contacts he had in the film industry, calling on graphic designer Saul Bass, whom Lucas had gotten to know while shooting second unit footage for Grand Prix. Bass, who had designed the visually stunning opening sequences for Hitchcock's North by Northwest and Otto Preminger's The Man with the Golden Arm, had been tapped by director John Frankenheimer to put together a similarly vibrant title sequence for Grand Prix, slotted for release in December. Lucas, a lover of montages, helped Bass cut together the footage for the film's exciting, roaring opening moments. That same summer, Bass was working on a documentary of his own called Why Man Creates, which would win an Academy Award in 1968, and would rely on Lucas to serve as a cameraman and jack of all trades. By early fall, Lucas's work with Bass was finished, and he was looking for a job again. He was still living in the house on Portola, still shutting himself in his top-floor room, though from time to time he could be persuaded to join a party of film school students and graduates. At one party that autumn, Lucas and Matthew Robbins were standing in the kitchen taking films when Lucas mentioned that he wanted to make a movie about someone escaping from the police, as Robbins recalled, from an all-pervasive Big Brother eye in the sky point of view. Robbins thought the idea sounded exciting and offered to take a crack at writing the story for it, eventually looping in Walter Murch to collaborate on a two-page treatment called Breakout, which they completed in early October. Mostly an extended chase sequence, the final scene describes the hero emerging from a trap door in the desert, yelping for joy, and running for freedom into the sunset. The happy ending that had been denied Lucas's young hero in Freiheit. As the man recedes, continues Robinson's treatment, a hand reaches out of the underground room, finds the handle on the trap door, and slowly closes it. The visual stuck with Lucas. He wanted to see that film. As soon as he could, he was going to make that film. But first, a job. After applying unsuccessfully for employment at the Hanna-Barbera Animation Studios, Lucas finally landed a position with the U.S. Information Agency as a grip, the person responsible for maintaining and carrying the camera equipment, for its teams working on education and propaganda films. It wasn't much, but it was still the kind of opportunity most film school graduates would have killed for. George Lucas, heir to a stationery store, car crash survivor, lover of photography and film, was officially working in the film industry, albeit just barely. Chapter 3. The Right Horse, 1967. Lucas returned to USC in January 1967, taking a few graduate film courses, including a class on film direction taught by comedian Jerry Lewis, a class he quickly came to loathe. Lewis had such an outrageous ego, said one classmate. Lucas would sink down into a seat in the back row of the classroom, glowering. Rather than seeking Lewis's instruction, most of the students had taken the class merely hoping the comedian could help them get into the vaunted Directors Guild of America. They would all be disappointed. At almost the same moment that Lucas started back at USC, he caught a lucky break. His friend Bob Dalva, who was editing and logging documentary footage at the U.S. Information Agency, was leaving his position and recommended Lucas as his replacement. Lucas, eager to start using USIA's equipment rather than lugging it, accepted and reported to the studios of veteran editor Verna Fields, who was working out of a facility she had set up in the garage of her San Fernando Valley home. Short and slightly stocky, with owlish glasses and a messy mop of dark hair, Fields, despite her unassuming looks and diminutive stature, was a larger-than-life personality, loud and brassy. As an editor, she was fast and very, very good, largely because, as one of the few women in a male-dominated profession, she had to be. "I got into movies by accident," she said later, and that was partly true. In the 1930s, while loitering around a movie studio with her boyfriend, she had been spotted by director Fritz Lang, who asked in his heavy German accent, "Who is that young girl always hanging around?" and hired her as a sound editing apprentice. 4 years of work got her into the unions, the golden ticket to the inside that so many others coveted. Fields stopped editing when she married and had children, until her husband died of a heart attack at age 38 in 1954, leaving her a single mother with two kids to support. Fields constructed editing rooms in her house and took jobs editing TV programs like Sky King and Fury. "I'd tell the kids I was the queen of Saturday morning," she laughed. Soon she moved into motion pictures, working on films like the experimental documentary Savage Eye and the Charlton Heston blockbuster El Cid. But the politically liberal, outspoken Fields was a crusader. "I was interested in using film for social reform," she said, and got enthusiastically caught up in President Johnson's Great Society, editing films for the U.S. government's Office of Economic Opportunity and the USIA. At the moment, she was editing a USIA film called Journey to the Pacific, about Johnson's visit to the region for the 1966 Manila Summit Conference, and she needed all the good editing hands she could get. Lucas, like nearly everyone else who worked for Fields, quickly came to adore her, but he just as rapidly learned to hate editing government films. "If you make a picture for the government, it wants to look good," said Lucas. "It's Hollywood invading everything." He was told that Lady Bird Johnson couldn't be shown at unflattering angles, while no shot could be used in which President Johnson's bald spot was visible. Even shots Lucas thought were artistic were scrutinized for potential offense. "I had put in a shot of a bunch of horses in Korea running down the street to help control the huge crowds," he said. "Someone thought it looked a little too fascist, which it wasn't, and made us take it out. I just liked the shot." While Lucas didn't like cutting together footage of someone saying things I didn't really believe in just because I had to make a living, more than anything else, he just didn't like being bossed around. Being told which shots he could and couldn't use annoyed him. The director would come over and say, "You can't cut this way. You've got to cut this way," said Lucas. And I said, "I don't like this." At that point, I was really wanting to be an editor and a cameraman. And in the course of doing this, I sort of said, "You know, maybe I want to be a director. I don't want people to tell me what to do." Lucas wasn't the only one working in Fields' editing rooms. While Fields had plumbed the classrooms at USC for students willing to edit and log footage, she had also hired more experienced professional editors from small production companies and paired them with the less experienced students. Lucas was placed alongside a young assistant editor from Sandler Films named Marcia Griffin, a year younger than Lucas, but who had already been supporting herself as a professional editor for more than a year. Griffin was a talented, intuitive editor, and, said John Plummer, she was cute as hell, with straight brown hair and a wispy voice. But Lucas was more threatened than impressed by her presence in the editing room. Marcia had a lot of disdain for the rest of us because we were all film students, Lucas recalled. She was the only real pro there. She had worked hard to get where she was, born in Modesto to an Air Force officer who abandoned his family when Marcia was two. She and her sister had been raised by their single mother in a small apartment in North Hollywood. With no child support coming in, Marcia's mother managed as best she could on her meager income as a clerk in an insurance agency, but money would always be tight. We had a lot of love and a supportive family, Marcia remembered, but economically, it was real hard on my mother. When she was a teenager, her father re-entered her life, and Marcia moved to Florida to live with him and his new family, a well-intentioned experiment that turned out to be a failure. After 2 years, she moved back to Hollywood, finished high school, then enrolled in evening chemistry classes at Los Angeles City College while working full-time in a mortgage banking firm to help support her mother and sister. Like Verna Fields, Marcia got into editing almost by accident. I just walked in off the street, she said. She had gone down to the California State Employment Office to apply for work as a librarian and was sent to the Sandler Film Library, which was looking for an apprentice film librarian. The job didn't pay as much as she was making at the bank, but she found she liked the work and was good at it. I would have cut film for free because I enjoyed it so much, she said. So far, her work was paying off. She had gotten into the union. Furthermore, she was willing to put in the effort to work her way through the apprentice editor system, an often frustrating 8-year process in which she was likely to see most of the higher profile editing jobs go to men, mainly because female editors were considered either too fragile to carry heavy film cans or too delicate to put up with the web of foul language that film editors typically wove while on the job. Working alongside Lucas, however, she was unlikely to hear much profanity, or much conversation at all, for that matter. When he was editing, Lucas preferred listening to music and rarely engaged in chatter, and when he did, he preferred to talk about film instead of anything personal. While Lucas remained wary and a bit daunted by this unwanted presence in the editing room, in truth, Marcia was slightly intimidated by him as well. She could see right away how good he was. He was so quiet and he said very little, but he seemed to be really talented and really centered. A very together person, said Marcia. I had come out of this hectic commercial production world, and here was this relaxed guy who threaded the moviola very slowly and cautiously. He handled the film with such reverence. For now, Lucas would remain aloof. Despite his wariness, Marcia intrigued him. In time, he thought, he might even talk to her. After spending his days in class, then sitting for hours at a moviola for Verna Fields, Lucas spent his evenings standing in front of a classroom at USC, serving as a teaching assistant for cinematography instructor Jean Peterson, a job he had taken to help defray some of his tuition costs. The evening class that Lucas taught had a unique enrollment. Peterson had a contract with the military to teach its cameramen, mostly Navy men and Air Force representatives, how to loosen up a bit, as Lucas put it. These veteran Navy cameramen had been taught to shoot film by the book. Lucas's job, then, was to make them think more like artists. I had to train the Navy guys to shoot using available light, to think about composition, and to try to get them to make a movie in a different way. Lucas likely caught a bit of razzing from the USC mafia, with the war in Vietnam taking up more and more of the front page each day, and student protesters taking out their frustrations on both politicians and returning soldiers alike. Teaching a class full of crew-cut servicemen seemed to some like fraternizing with the enemy. They sent these military guys to join all of us who had shaggy hair and who were protesting and marching, said Willard Hike, and we would have nothing to do with the military guys. Lucas, however, saw things a bit differently. Because the class he was teaching was sponsored and subsidized by the federal government, the Navy crews had better equipment than the average USC film class, and more important, they had nearly unlimited access to color film with sound. What Lucas saw then was a classroom filled with great equipment, limitless supplies of film, and a crew that could take orders well. He could do things entirely his way, with all the equipment and film he needed. Lucas's gut instinct was correct. The military crews did take orders well. They just didn't take them well from him. Astutely reading the mood of the room, Lucas decided to play to their competitive spirit. He broke the class into two teams, one of which he would lead to make his film, while the other group would follow the lead of their ranking officer. It was a contest the opposing team was destined to lose right from the beginning, for Lucas already knew what film he was going to make. He was going to make that movie he'd discussed with Matthew Robbins and Walter Murch in a Hollywood kitchen, the one about the man emerging from underground and running for freedom. There was going to be very little plot. With only 12 weeks to complete the project, Lucas wanted to concentrate more on the look and feel of the film rather than plot or characters, a criticism that would be lobbed at some of his later films as well. "I liked the idea of doing something futuristic," Lucas said. "I wanted to do something extremely visual that had no dialogue and no characters, a cross between a theatrical and non-theatrical experience, something a little experimental." Actually, it was going to be a lot experimental, as Lucas had some unconventional ideas that had, he said, been boiling around in my mind for a long time. First, as in Godard's Alphaville, Lucas was going to use the present to represent the future. There would be no need to build space-age sets or props. With some clever camera work and a bit of tape and fabric, Lucas could make 1960s-era clothing and machinery look futuristic, yet still somehow shop-worn and vaguely familiar. The used universe mentality he would later bring to Star Wars. Plus, with the power of military clearances behind him, Lucas could access computer rooms and other facilities at locations that would normally be closed to him, including LAX, Van Nuys Airport, and an underground parking area at UCLA. To the greatest extent possible, too, he was going to use only natural lighting, which would give the film a documentary sensibility, almost a feeling of found footage that had somehow made its way back from 1967 from the future. He had a new cinematic muse as well, yet another product of the National Film Board of Canada, an eclectic black-and-white film called 2187 by a brilliant 30-year-old montagist named Arthur Lipset. Lucas admitted to watching the film 20 or 30 times. "It had a very powerful effect on me," Lucas said later. "It was very much the kind of thing that I wanted to do. I was extremely influenced by that particular movie." Not only would it have a profound impact on the way he thought about and used sound in his films, but also it would even subtly inspire a key part of Lucas's Star Wars mythos. For 2187, Lipset created a nearly 10-minute film montage using short movies he had taken in New York City, along with random bits of film picked up off the editing room floor at the National Film Board. The result is jarring and fascinating. Regular people going about their everyday lives, walking in the park, talking on phones, commuting to work, intercut with bizarre, often unsettling footage, like a horse jumping from a diving board, an autopsy, or a smiling, disembodied prop head advertising cigarettes in a store window. But it's Lipset's unique sense of sound that gives the images their vivid, almost subversive feel, infecting everything on screen with mood and personality. Lipset's soundtrack buzzes and whirs with fragments of conversations about morality, the Bible, and ruminations on God. Blues and gospel play over couples dancing and young men shooting one another with toy pistols. A choir exults as people laugh at their distorted images in funhouse mirrors and as commuters exit an escalator. "When George saw 2187, a light bulb went off," said Walter Murch. "One of the things we clearly wanted to do was to make a film where the sound and the pictures were free-floating. In one memorable moment, especially as it affected Lucas, Lipset inserts over images of fluttering pigeons a snippet of an existential discussion between Warren S. McCulloch, a pioneer of artificial intelligence, and cinematographer Roman Kreuter. As McCulloch contends that human beings are merely complicated machines, Kreuter counters that it can't be that simple or soulless, arguing that as humans contemplate the world around them, they become aware of some kind of force behind this apparent mask which we see in front of us, and they call it God. A decade later, Lucas would acknowledge that his own version of the Force, while based on the universal idea of life forces, was a tip of the hat to Lipset, an echo of that phrase in 2187. Lucas would borrow one more conceit from 2187. "I think that's one reason I started calling most of my college movies by numbers," he said. This film, then, would be named for its main character, designated in Lucas's dystopia as THX-1138-4EB, as Vorkopich had done with his main character in Life and Death of 9413, a Hollywood extra. Lucas would emblazon his hero's identifying number across his forehead. Although Lucas always insisted that the letters THX don't mean anything, Matthew Robbins, who had left the protagonist unnamed in his first treatment, thought Lucas might simply have liked the look of the three letters, pointing out that the letters T, H, and X are all symmetrical. Others speculated that Lucas had coyly lifted the title from his phone number 849-1138, with the letters THX corresponding to the numbers 8, 4, and 9 on the phone's dial. Lucas filmed THX-1138-4EB over three long, grueling days in January 1967. He would work his Navy film crew hard all night, lugging equipment into computer labs and parking lots to catch his main character sprinting down one hallway after another as his pursuers monitor him from a control room. At times, it was practically guerrilla filmmaking, as Lucas and his crew would shoot as much as they could in a parking garage before the light changed or they had run out of time. And even with the military's equipment at their disposal, there were still shortages and equipment failures. Through it all, Lucas simply coped and improvised, with a resilience that impressed the hardened Navy officers. Lacking a proper dolly for moving shots, for instance, Lucas and cameraman Zip Zimmerman simply mounted the camera sturdily onto their shoulders and sat stone still on a rolling platform as it was towed slowly backward. Making things even tougher, Lucas was still working full-time for Verna Fields, sorting and editing footage of President Johnson for Journey to the Pacific during the day before returning to his own film at night. The pace was exhausting. Fields would often catch Lucas asleep at his moviola, head down, as film slowly unspooled onto the floor. At night, he often barely had the strength to carry the movie camera, opting instead to cradle it in his arms rather than perching it on his shoulder. Much of the time, he would leave the camera work to Zimmerman, preferring to direct from one side. The three-day shoot was going to be the easy part anyway. Lucas would be doing the real work on his film all by himself, in the editing room, where he would add optical effects, on-screen chroma key, and an interesting, aggressive soundtrack. With filming complete, an exhausted Lucas took his film cans over to Fields's place, where he planned to spend the next 10 weeks editing the film on her moviolas at night. With filming on THX complete, though there were still weeks of editing to be done, Lucas turned to his next project, Anyone Lived in a Pretty Howe Town, an arty 6-minute film inspired by the E.E. Cummings poem of the same name. For the first time, Lucas had full-color 35mm cinemascope at his disposal, though it hadn't been easy. "On this one, we weren't even allowed to shoot in color," Lucas said. "It was a 5-week project, and they said we couldn't possibly do color in 5 weeks, because it took almost a week just to get the dailies back." But Lucas decided to do it anyway, working again with Paul Golding, his collaborator on Herbie, and a good-sized crew, including several actors with costumes and props. Lucas shot the film over 12 days, 9 more than it had taken to shoot THX, on a budget of only $40, and finished the film in the 5-week deadline. We were one of the only crews to finish, Lucas said, though he admitted he and his team had received a dressing down at the hands of instructor Douglas Cox for shooting in color after he had advised against it. Lucas continued to edit THX late into the evenings, paying particular attention to the way the film sounded. He and Walter Murch, who found editing sound intoxicating, had talked about the importance of sound often, and both knew that the right soundtrack could transform a film into an experience. They had seen it firsthand at USC, where the screening room was situated in such a way that sound would funnel down the hallway and out onto the open patio. And when there was a really interesting sounding film, Lucas explained, the whole department would come rushing in to see what it was. Lucas, then, would always want the sound and music in his movies to be as clear and immersive as possible, a campaign he would deftly wage through his entire career, not only choosing the dynamic conductor John Williams to score his films, but also successfully advocating for theater sound systems with better speakers and acoustics. As Lucas hunched over the moviola in Fields' editing room, culling through footage of Lyndon Johnson during the day, then spooling THX-1138-4EB back and forth all night, he found himself talking more and more easily with Marcia. Their casual chatter was still mostly about films, but Lucas liked that she could talk about filmmaking with the same excitement, the same appreciation for the technical side of things that he could. Until Marcia, the few women Lucas had dated in college were mostly into what he thought were a lot of dumb things. But here was someone who wanted to talk storylines and film mechanics, and who also shared his disdain for the Hollywood system, even as she was trying to work her way up through it. She was smart and easy to talk to, so Lucas finally summoned the nerve to ask her out. Sort of. It wasn't really a date, Lucas said of their outing to the AFI headquarters in Beverly Hills to watch a film by a mutual friend. But that was the first time we were ever alone together. There were more conversations in their apartments, followed by more movies, and suddenly, before either quite realized it, they were dating. Marcia and I got along real well, said Lucas plainly. For her part, Marcia was attracted to his drive and intensity, but she also found him surprisingly cute and funny and silly. They seemed an unlikely couple. Whereas Lucas was serious and brooding, Marcia, said classmate Richard Walter, was very bright and upbeat, just the loveliest woman you ever saw in your life. Milius, never one to mince words, thought Lucas was clearly outclassed. We all wondered how little George got this great-looking girl, Milius snorted, though he thought he knew the answer. Marcia was smart, too, obsessed with films. And he added impishly, she was a better editor than he was. Golding, however, thought they looked great together. They're both so little, he said matter-of-factly. Lucas's next student film was an ambitious black-and-white documentary spotlighting Los Angeles radio personality Bob Hudson, a blowhard of a DJ who called himself the Emperor. Lucas, who had spent most of his teens listening to DJs chatter as he cruised Modesto, had wanted to make a documentary about a radio personality for some time. People develop this relationship with people on the radio, said Lucas. They think of them as being one way, and they create a sort of ambiance about themselves. People get very close to the people on the radio, except, of course, they're not close at all. He had initially wanted to make a film about the enigmatic Wolfman Jack, who in 1967 was burning up American airwaves with 250,000 watts from Tijuana radio station XERB behind him. But I didn't know where he was, said Lucas. Hudson, then, had been a happy accident. George and I were both listening to the Emperor Hudson radio show at the time, said Paul Golding, and we both tried to call each other at the exact same time that we were listening to his show because we both knew that we had to make a film about this guy. Lucas and Golding regrouped with their small team from Pretty Howtown for their documentary, which was originally to have been 10 minutes long, except that Lucas and Golding were rather ambitious and envisioned the film as a kind of half-hour television show, complete with commercials. Lucas badgered their instructors for more film, getting into several loud arguments before he succeeded in prying loose enough film to shoot additional footage, on the condition that the final project be edited down to no more than 10 minutes. I got used to shooting a ton of material and making a movie out of it in the editing room, said Lucas. He had no intention of complying with the demand that he limit the film to 10 minutes. Lucas would shoot The Emperor throughout most of March and April 1967, filming Hudson as he ranted on the air and over the phone, even getting him to sit for interviews. He had no idea what was going to happen with us being in his studio, said Golding, and he didn't want anyone in there screwing up his radio show. Hudson eventually came to trust and enjoy Lucas and his film crew, even taking part in an on-screen gag in which Hudson emerges from his car flanked by jackbooted bodyguards, played by Lucas and Golding in Hitchcock-style cameos. When they weren't trailing along after Hudson, Lucas shot fake ads that gave off a whiff of Mad Magazine and an even more distinctive scent of pot, including an ad for a Camaro that turns out to be a rhinoceros instead of a car, and bananas that could be smoked, the latter featuring Milius playing a Mexican bandito with smirking relish. It was a good experience for everyone involved. It was filmmaking at its purest, recalled Golding. We all worked together wonderfully, and we were all very open to each other's ideas. Milius, too, would always regard The Emperor as one of Lucas's defining films. He was a great graphic kind of artist in a way, said Milius. He had a definite kind of visual orientation towards things, a great sense of what he wanted to do, you know, and he did unusual things. Indeed, one of The Emperor's most unusual and jarring moments comes halfway through the film, when the credits begin to roll, seeming to mark the end of the movie. It was actually a fake-out aimed at naysaying USC instructors, making it appear as if Lucas had complied with their demands to end the movie after 10 minutes. At the film's first screening, recalled Golding, you could hear this wave of sadness and disappointment in the crowd, because everyone knew about the battles that we had been fighting with the school to shoot this, and they had thought we had caved in on the school's demands. When the audience realized that the film continued for another 12 minutes after the credits, the theater erupted with excitement. Every minute of it past those titles, said Golding puckishly, was our deliberate attack on the facility. Lucas soaked in the applause with satisfaction. He'd been right. Again. That spring, Marcia moved in with Lucas in his hilltop apartment on Portola. Friends scratched their heads. The two of them seemed so unalike. But both Lucas and Marcia thought that was exactly what made them perfect for each other. I always felt I was an optimist because I'm extroverted, and I always thought that George was more introverted, quiet, and pessimistic, said Marcia. Lucas was typically inscrutable. Marcia and I are very different and also very much alike, he said. If pressed, he also had to admit he liked that she made him dinner every night. When Lucas's parents saw the two of them together, they could tell by the relative ease with which he acted around her that she was the one. Cementing the deal in the minds of many Lucas family members, Lucas confessed to his brother-in-law, Marcia is the only person I've ever known who can make me raise my voice. Coming from the low-key Lucas, that was high praise indeed. In the weeks after the release of The Emperor, Lucas finally completed work on THX 1138EB. He was pleased with it. I didn't expect it to turn out so well, he admitted, and had worked hard to make the film a senses-swapping experience. Visually, Lucas had filled the screen with plenty of high-tech tricks. Images are distorted or streaked with static, like the flicker of a barely tuned-in television channel. Numbers run down the sides and across the bottom of the screen, giving the viewer a disorienting feeling of watching everything on a video monitor, just as THX's pursuers do. Some sequences appear to be filmed by a surveillance camera, while others are tinted orange, as seen through the visor of a policeman's helmet, with an on-screen display indicating we're seeing the view from Perfect Bod 2180. At one point, the date flashes past, 5/14/2187, Lucas's on-screen nod to Lipset's influential film. Lucas's weeks of attention to the soundtrack had paid off too, for even today, few other films sound like it. There was this wild mixture of Bach, said Walter Murch. And skittering around in that were the chatterings of almost undistinguishable voices in air traffic control, or something like that. Lucas borrowed interesting music from any place he could find it, using the Yardbirds' haunting Still I'm Sad over the opening credits, and loud organ chords reverberating over THX's triumphant sprint into the sunset in the movie's closing moments. Plot-wise, Lucas added an additional undercurrent of paranoia, with THX's mate, YYO7117, being interrogated by the state, represented by a Christ-like figure with 0000 across his forehead, for the crime of sex act. There are lots of extended sequences of people pushing buttons and operating machinery, as well as shots of THX running down endless hallways, arms flailing. And yet, with Lucas's rapid-fire editing, on-screen effects, and surreal sounds, it's all somehow exciting. Quite simply, THX 1138-4EB works. I was into trying to create emotions through pure cinematic techniques, Lucas said later. All the films I made during that time center on conveying emotions through a cinematic experience, not necessarily through the narrative. Throughout my career, I've remained a cinema enthusiast. Even though I went on to make films with a more conventional narrative, I've always tried to convey emotions through essentially cinematic experiences. It was indeed a cinematic experience. Its debut was nothing short of a happening. Students cheered from the moment the USC logo appeared on screen and elevated to a roar as its color slowly transitioned from yellow to blood red. The success of THX also went a long way toward mitigating some of the continuing tension between father and son. While George Lucas Sr. had long accepted that his son was determined to be a filmmaker, that didn't mean he had to be happy about it. But watching his son's films at a USC student film festival, with the audience buzzing enthusiastically around him, he could appreciate that his son had not only found his calling, but also earned the respect of his peers. Now, I had been against this thing of his going to the cinema school from day one, but we guessed he had finally found his niche, said George Sr. As we drove home, I said to Dorothy, I think we put our money on the right horse. Feeling both confident and vindicated by THX 1138 4EB, Lucas applied for a student scholarship offered by Columbia Pictures and writer-producer Carl Foreman, who was overseeing production on the Gregory Peck film McKenna's Gold in Utah and Arizona. Foreman was offering an opportunity for four students, two from UCLA, two from USC, to watch his film crew at work and, more important, to spend their time producing short films on the making of McKenna's Gold that Foreman could later use to promote the movie. To Lucas's likely disappointment, he wasn't one of the two USC students selected. Instead, scholarships went to classmates Charlie Lippincott and Chuck Braverman. At the last moment, however, Lippincott backed out after landing a job with an assistant director at Columbia Pictures and recommended Lucas as his replacement. And off Lucas went to the Arizona desert to hook up with Foreman and the crew of McKenna's Gold. It was the first time he had the chance to see a major motion picture being made. And Lucas, never a patient bystander to begin with, wasn't impressed. We had never been around such opulence, zillions of dollars being spent every 5 minutes on this huge, unwieldy thing, Lucas said later. It was mind-boggling to us because we had been making films for $300 and seeing this incredible waste. That was the worst of Hollywood. Lost on Lucas, however, was the fact that he was benefiting from such largesse. For Foreman had provided his four young filmmakers, besides Lucas and Braverman from USC, there were J. David Wiles and David McDougall from UCLA, with the equipment and transportation they would need to make their own short films, and was even paying each of them a weekly stipend, most of which Lucas would pocket. Lucas could still work in the guerrilla style he preferred, but Foreman was providing him with some of the best equipment of his fledgling career to do it. Despite his distaste for the opulence on set, Lucas was privately hoping that his experience on McKenna's Gold might finally pry open the doors to a job in Hollywood, and he wanted to make a good impression on Forman. It would be an uphill battle, for Forman, who had written High Noon and overseen the highly profitable films The Guns of Navarone and Born Free, had a reputation for being prickly, and perhaps for good reason. He had been blacklisted during the Red Scare in the 1950s and had exiled himself to London for more than a decade. McKenna's Gold marked his first major project since his return to the United States. If Lucas was hoping to ingratiate himself with Forman, however, he got off to a shaky start. Although Forman had essentially given his four young filmmakers carte blanche for making their films, they would have no supervision, no one spot-checking their work. He did ask for approval of their subjects. Wiles offered to make a film about the horse wranglers, while McDougall would shadow director J. Lee Thompson, and Braverman would follow around Forman himself. Lucas, who admitted to being a very hostile kid in those days, wanted nothing that conventional, and offered to make a tone poem in the vein of 14208 instead. Forman tried to talk him out of it, but the more he objected, the deeper Lucas dug in. If they were going to give a scholarship to make a movie, then I wanted to make a movie, Lucas protested. I wasn't going to do some promo film to advertise the picture. Lucas would go off on his own. Forman would later accuse him of snubbing his fellow filmmakers, a charge Lucas denied. Filming the desert scenery, the enormous skies, the windmills and prairie dogs, with mere glimpses of the film crew for McKenna's Gold in the background. Trespassers visible only from afar. Lucas named his movie for the date he completed filming, calling it 6-18-67, another numerically named film. Part John Ford Western, part tone poem, it was also, Lucas told Marcia, a film about you, because no matter what I'm photographing, I pretend and wish that it is you. But Forman wasn't impressed, complaining that Lucas's arty 4-minute film was in direct defiance of the original assignment and had little to do with McKenna's Gold. A year later, however, when 6-18-67 was shown on a Los Angeles PBS station, Forman grudgingly admitted that Lucas had made a statement. Life in the desert went on before us, and life went on after us, said Forman, and that's what George's film was all about. Lucas returned to Los Angeles in June, where, to his surprise, he found that he and Walter Murch had been nominated for the highly coveted Samuel Warner Memorial Scholarship. The scholarship was another of those opportunities to observe. Watching doesn't teach you anything, Lucas grumbled. But it did send the winner to the Warner Brothers Studios to work for 6 months in any department of his choosing, and even paid a weekly stipend of $80. It was a big deal, Lucas admitted, and, given his lost opportunity with Forman, it might even offer another chance to break into the tightly closed Hollywood system. As he and Murch waited on the USC patio for the scholarship's selection committee to inform them of the winner, the two of them vowed that whoever won the scholarship would somehow use the opportunity to help the other. Lucas won, and years later would make good on their pact, hiring Murch to edit sound for American Graffiti. We were good friends throughout my time at the department, and I was able to help him out later, said Lucas warmly. In those days, everybody was helping each other. As Lucas quickly discovered, it wasn't a good time to be at Warner Brothers. Warner, like most of the major studios, was a dinosaur that appeared to be slowly lumbering toward extinction. Attendance at movies had plummeted over the previous two decades. In the early 1950s, movie theaters in the United States were already selling 34 million fewer tickets each week than they had only 3 years earlier, largely because of an upstart invention called television that provided viewers with more entertainment options and made them available in the comfort of their homes. Looking for audiences, studios began making sprawling, big-budget films, many of which dragged the studios down when they failed to take hold at the box office, including, most famously, director Joseph Mankiewicz's 1963 film Cleopatra, which nearly bankrupted 20th Century Fox. In 1967, the musical bomb Camelot would cripple Warner in a similar manner. Furthermore, the moguls were dead or retiring. At Warner, in fact, 75-year-old studio head Jack Warner had recently sold his stock to Seven Arts and was preparing to head across town to set up his own production company. As the studios hemorrhaged money, in-house actors and writers were let go, making things worse. As the vice grip of unions squeezed studio bottom lines, many studio heads found it cheaper and easier to abandon making films in the studios in favor of filming on location or with foreign film crews. Sound stages were shuttered. For a moment, Lucas held out hope that he might be able to pursue animation at Warner's famous animation unit, which had produced a seemingly endless stream of quality Looney Tunes cartoons for decades. But that, too, had been closed since 1963 and would not reopen. "Everything was shut down," said Lucas. "It was like a ghost town." As it turned out, not everything was shut down. There was one movie in production on the lot, just starting a 12-week shoot under a rookie director, a film adaptation of the shop-worn musical Finian's Rainbow, starring an equally shop-worn 68-year-old Fred Astaire. Lucas groaned as he reported to the set. "I wasn't really interested," he said. "I had just finished one scholarship watching McKenna's Gold, and by this time I had pretty much decided I didn't want to go into the theatrical film business anyway. I wanted to be a documentary cameraman." And now, here he was, stuck at a nearly deserted Warner Brothers lot, playing the dreaded role of observer again, and to a greenhorn director, no less. Lucas loitered around the set of Finian's Rainbow for several days, quietly watching, observing, with his arms folded, mouth set tight. Eventually, the director noticed the skinny young man watching him and asked someone who it was. Learning that his guest was a student observer from USC, he coyly sidled over to the stone-faced Lucas between takes. "See anything interesting?" he asked Lucas. Lucas shook his head slowly. "Nope," he said flatly, making a quick sideways cut with his hand, palm down. "Not yet." "And this," said the director, a burly, bearded 28-year-old named Francis Ford Coppola, "is how I met George Lucas."